Hello and welcome to National League Town, Mets fandom, Mets history, Mets life, with Long Island's own Greg Prince and Jeff Heisen. Hey, Greg.
Pull up a chair, Jeff. It's time for a podcast about baseball.
On today's show, we talk about the trade deadline, Jake's return, and why Starling Marte reminds Greg of a great Met from years ago. But first, the legendary Vin Scully passed away yesterday, and he was and always will remain a significant voice in National League Town.
Vin Scully takes us back to our roots in many ways, the roots of this podcast in the conceptual sense. We have experienced Vin Scully as a national broadcaster. We remember him fondly from the NBC days, from one World Series in particular in 1986, and we know that all these years he has been the beacon of baseball in Southern California. But of course, he got his start in Brooklyn, listened to by Dodger fans like Murray Heisen and many who lived in the borough and loved the Dodgers, you know, which was ironic because Vin Scully grew up a Giants fan up in Washington Heights and went to Fordham University in the Bronx. It's a real New York story. So when we look back on Vin Scully's career, we look, you know, before we started as baseball fans and remember that he was a big reason people loved baseball in New York, loved National League baseball in New York. And of course, he became the major reason people cottoned, if you will, to baseball in Los Angeles and gave all of us within the sounds of his voice. 67 seasons, my God, that's 2/3 of a century. And, you know, the longevity, I think, is only the subtext because it's the work he did behind the mic, the friends he made with all of us, even those who never met him, and those of us who learned so much about baseball, learned the ins and outs, learned about the players. He took every at-bat seriously, never took an at-bat off. And that's why there's such a loss right now. Even though Vin Scully's been retired for a few years, never felt like he was going away. You know, I think of a song that R.E.M. did in 1996 called Electrolyte, specifically the first line of the song, 20th century go to sleep. It's kind of felt like that the last year, 2 years, when Hank Aaron died, when John Madden died, when Roger Angel died, who is sort of the allegory for Vin Scully, but with the written word, when Bill Russell died just a couple of days before Vin Scully did. It really transcends just the idea of, oh, these were very famous people and they were very good at what they did. These were the absolute icons in their fields, and to a certain degree, it felt like, well, these guys are never going away. At any given moment, they could come back on our television, get behind a microphone, write an article. Doesn't work that way. So there's a void right now in the heart of baseball. And you know, it's sort of touching to see how many people sort of come together virtually and through whatever media they communicate to express how much they loved Vin Scully and how much he meant to them and how much he meant to the game.
There was a moment of silence for him today at Nationals Park, and I'm sure there will be on Thursday at Citi Field. One thing about Vin Scully's announcing that's so interesting is that he was alone in the booth, and there was no Gary, Keith, and Ron. There was no Vince and two other Dodgers. It was just him, and that's all he needed.
You know, we saw him with Joe Garagiola a lot. That was the exception, though. And earlier in his career, he worked with Red Barber. He worked with Connie Desmond. He worked with Jerry Doggett. He had some other partners along the way. But a long time ago, he shed some baggage, shall we say. And it was decided Vin Scully alone is like what they say about the greatest meeting of minds in the White House since Thomas Jefferson dined alone. That's what it's like listening to Vin Scully when you come across any of those broadcasts. And again, wasn't so long ago, he was on the air late at night for the East Coasters One of the best things about having what was then XM radio and later Sirius XM radio was access to every major league home game. And when the Dodgers were home, I would turn the radio on late at night. Sometimes the game would be on TV, but I would turn the sound down and just listen to Vin. And, you know, what a great place to spend the night in the company of Vin Scully's voice.
He only broadcast in Brooklyn for 8 years, but it seems so much longer. The impact of those 8 years, it's impossible to disassociate the Brooklyn Dodgers from Vin Scully.
Well, Vin Scully had the pleasure and privilege of being on the air on October 4th, 1955, and got to make the announcement, and I'm paraphrasing, the Brooklyn Dodgers are champions of the world. And then, as he recalled it, he stayed silent, partly to let the crowd wash over the scene, because he didn't step on sound when there was no need to, and partly because he didn't think he could keep it together, because he knew this was such a momentous occasion in terms of Vin Scully's import to the history of New York baseball. You could draw something of a parallel with somebody else who only spent 7 years, and really 6 years, because one of them he was in the Army, in New York in the 1950s, Willie Mays, who happened to have been Vin Scully's favorite player ever. He revealed that. I don't think it was a secret, but he made a point of saying so the very last games he did, which were in San Francisco, and Willie Mays visited with him. And there they were, these icons of New York baseball in the 50s who would never be forgotten in New York. Vin Scully from Brooklyn, Willie Mays from uptown, and here they were in California together one more time. And of course, you know, as we've discussed before, Willie Mays came home to New York to the Mets for a couple of years. Vin Scully came back to New York to do road games and to do network games. God knows how many Mets games he did that we never heard, because he was doing them for Dodger radio or Dodger television. But we certainly got our share of Vin Scully in the fall of 1986. Seven of the most important games in Mets history, including two of the most decisive or influential games in Mets history, games 6 and 7 of the World Series. And that call, a little roller up the first baseline, gets through Buckner. We know what that means. And, you know, I will confess, on the night of October 25th, 1986, really after midnight, October 26th, 1986, I had the sound down on my television because I wanted to live or die with Bob Murphy, because he's our guy. And Vin Scully and Joe Garagiola were talking to a national audience, as they should have been. I wanted to hear our guys. I wanted to hear Bob Murphy and Gary Thorne. So in the moment, my experience was trickling gets by Buckner. And that worked for me too, because I could see the picture and I could figure out what was going on. With no offense whatsoever to Bob Murphy, Scully's call is more accurate. It got through him. Mm-hmm. Say it went through his legs. It got through Buckner. And I think the image we have of that play lives on because of that description precisely. And then the silence from the booth, because it was just too crazy to talk over. And Vin Scully, who'd been doing baseball for about 35 years at that point, understood that Shea Stadium had more to say that was relevant than he could. So he let Shea Stadium speak before he came back with that beautiful line about, if a picture says 1,000 words, you've just seen 1,000,000 words. And then, of course, came game 7. And then the thing is, and Gary Cohn mentioned this when he was interviewed on SNY Sports Night after the news broke. You have to remember, he was ready to make a call saying that the Boston Red Sox were world champions, which, of course, was his job. Not that we would have wanted to have heard that, but he had a whole other storyline ready to go. Much like you hear columnists and beat writers talk about, we all had to, like, tear up our leads and start over. Well, NBC is broadcasting a whole other story that night. Remember, the Miller Lite player of the game is Bruce Hurst. or Marty Barrett. I'm trying to remember who it was. I guess it was Marty Barrett.
Marty Barrett.
Bruce Hurst. Yeah, Bruce Hurst. Bruce Hurst was the MVP in waiting. Thank you. So, and I think that quite honestly was one of the reasons I had tuned away from the TV that night, because let's face it, the Boston Red Sox winning their first World Series in 68 years was a fantastic story, and you cannot blame NBC or Vin or Joe for leaning into that a little bit in an anticipation. And of course, me, the Mets fan, doesn't want to hear about it. I just want to hear Bob Murphy's voice. But Lord knows I have watched that game many times. I have the DVD, and every time, whether it's MLB Network or SNY or any other outlet has replayed it, I sit down. I have no trouble listening to Vin Scully call Game 6 or Game 7 of the 1986 World Series.
One of my favorite anecdotes I read a few years ago was in an article about Marv Albert. And if you're a New York sports fan, it's impossible not to like Marv Albert. Well, he said that when he was growing up in Brooklyn, he would go to Ebbets Field to practice being an announcer. I'm sure he took Al and Steve with him. And after the game was over, he'd go into the broadcast booth where Vin Scully had read commercial copy and crumpled it up and thrown it on the ground, and he would scurry in to pick it up. So for the next broadcast that he was making believe he was doing, he could read the same copy of that Vin Scully did.
And I'm sure if Marv had just asked, I'm sure Vin would have handed it to him, because he was an all-time mensch. Again, the stories we've heard from those who not only worked with him, but worked, you know, one booth over. So I think it stays with me from 2016, which was essentially Vin's farewell tour, at least over the air, because he didn't actually go from ballpark to ballpark at that stage of his career, was when the Mets were in Los Angeles that season. Usually when the Mets are in town somewhere and they want to do an interview with the other team's announcer or somebody connected to that team, they send the guys who do interviews. So by then, Steve Gelbs had what we still think of as Kevin Burkhardt's job. And Wayne Randazzo was the pregame and postgame host on Mets Extra. And normally that's who they would send to go talk to the other team. Not that time, because Vin Scully was the guest. He was the get. It's the guy we want to hear from back in New York. And I don't know exactly what the thought process was. Both Howie Rose and Gary Cohn, respectively, on radio and TV said, I'm going to handle this. Or some producer said, well, we think it might be better to send our top guys, no offense to the younger guys, to talk to Vin Scully. Or maybe Vin Scully said, hey, I'd love to talk to you guys. Whatever it was, like, you never see Gary Cohn sit down and do an interview with the other announcer. Or you don't really hear Howie Rose do those interviews. You did in 2016, because it was such a special occasion to say goodbye to Vin Scully. And you could see how much it meant to these guys who, at that point, much as, you know, Marv Albert became, you know, they were long experienced broadcasters, but they all looked up to Vin Scully. And Vin Scully, of course, gave great stuff. You know, one of the things that amazes me about Vin Scully is how many times he must have answered the same questions, probably more than anybody else alive, because the first question is always, Vin, when did you know that you wanted to be an announcer? And it was always the same story, which is fair, because he had one answer, and it was the answer of being a little kid and hearing the radio in his parents' living room and getting a box of crackers and sticking his head basically underneath the console and letting the roar of the crowd wash over me, and I knew I wanted to be a part of that, words to that effect. And I said, wow, he tells this story over and over as if it's the first time he's ever told it, as if the questioner had something original to ask. And he probably made every reporter, especially the young reporters, feel very welcome and very good by not saying, well, you can just go look that up online somewhere, kid. Everybody knows how I got into the business, but he was too good a man for that. And would you really not want to hear Vin Scully tell the story of how he became interested in broadcasting? You know, you eat it up with a spoon, with a box of crackers, to use his anecdote.
We thank Vin Scully. May he rest in peace. And now we move on. The trade deadline has come and gone. The Mets acquired Michael Givens, Darren Ruff, Daniel Vogelbach, and Tyler Naquin, but they did not get a left-handed relief pitcher. Greg, was this enough for the first-place Mets?
We're going to find out, aren't we? We're going to find out over the final 58 games and then probably some games that will come after that. I would posit that along with Vogelbach, Naquin, Ruff, Givens, they also got a relief pitcher named Trevor May. They're getting a catcher named James McCann. Oh, and didn't they get a starting pitcher who wears number 48? That's right. They got Jacob DeGrom. You know, you kind of gave away the answer that I'm thinking of there. The first place Mets. There's no team that can't use some tweaking, but that's where the Mets are, I believe. So this wasn't shoot for the moon 2015, oh my God, we need Yoenis Cespedes type of a trade deadline. The left-handed reliever, the now mythical left-handed reliever the Mets didn't get, I wish they had gotten him. I'm not sure who it would have been. I'm sure they made plenty of inquiries. I guess it just didn't happen. I think I've been so happy with this team all year that I can't default to, I love this team and now I want to replace like a quarter of it. But in fact, they have replaced a quarter of it just through these four guys, plus the three guys coming off the injured list. So I think they've upgraded in certain spots. And I think there are a couple of spots, to be perfectly honest, you're going to cross your fingers a little bit.
I'm stunned that they didn't get a left-handed relief pitcher. But I've been saying the same thing since the preseason. They didn't get Andrew Chafin then. They didn't get him now. I think it's possible to believe two things. The first place Mets, the team that has a 100% chance of making the playoffs, according to Fangraphs, got better. We saw today, we're taping this on Wednesday night, what Daniel Vogelbach can do. But it's also believable that Billy Epler failed because he did not get a left-handed reliever, and you could argue that he should have also gotten a catcher. The catcher's position, we said on this show that they wouldn't get Wilson Contreras. Well, nobody got Wilson Contreras. And as you said, we don't know what the other teams were offering or what they wanted. But the Mets didn't get Christian Vasquez. He went to Houston. The Mets didn't get Sean Murphy. He stayed in Oakland. The Mets still have Tomas Nito. He had a well-struck hit today, but yesterday, down three runs, two on, seventh inning, he bunts. Picture that in the World Series. The Mets needed a better bat from behind the plate. Who knows? Maybe James McCann will come back on Thursday and be resurrected. But they didn't get a catcher and they didn't get a lefty reliever. Billy Epler said he refrained from making an impulse decision for marginal gains. Oddly, that's the same thing I say to myself before considering a second donut. Billy Epler also said undisciplined thinking can lead to years of mediocrity. Yeah. What else, Billy? Billy Epler said that if you're subtracting 1% or 1.5% aggregate over a 4 or 5 year period to move up 1% now, I don't think that's how sustainability works. Yeah, but maybe you don't need that 1% next year. You don't know what's going to happen. You know that this year's team is good. This year's team may be special. Maybe they need that left-handed reliever. My argument would be that that's bad logic because trading prospects doesn't lose you 1% next year. And you can always recoup what you lose in the prospect through a free agent signing. We're supposed to be pro free agent signings under the Cohn administration. If you told me that the Mets traded Ronnie Mauricio for Gregory Soto, even though they wouldn't have Soto control after this year, I would have been thrilled because Soto is great. But the Mets don't have Soto. They don't have any left-handed reliever right now other than David Peterson, apparently. And we don't know how good David Peterson's going to be out of the bullpen. Think about his appearance against the Yankees. He's good as a starter. It doesn't mean he's going to be as good as a reliever. And they have Joely Rodriguez, who, let's be charitable and say, is inconsistent. The Mets this year can win it all. I would have liked to have seen a little more from Billy Epler.
I'm thinking after your reaction to the Billy Epler should have said no comment after he didn't make any trades, because he's trying to spin and he's trying to rationalize, and he's probably being as honest as he can be, talking in the language a general manager in 2022 speaks in. If we're just going to look at, hey, cliche alert, if we're just going to look at the bottom line and say your job was to get a more effective hitting catcher and a proven left-handed relief pitcher, then yes, he failed at those tasks. But we can feel pretty good that he went after it. So I won't say he failed. May not have delivered, but I don't think he was out there not trying to get one. And I'm not going to make this a Rorschach test of, do you love prospects? Do you love these particular prospects? Don't we have to build the farm system? But I guess you have to kind of think in those terms, as well as, this is the year. Do we give up prospect A to get piece B? And we'll say piece because, again, we're not looking for Yoenis Cespedes from 2015. That was not what we were looking for. Listen, Joely Rodriguez, as you said, is not always a Joely good left-handed relief pitcher, and we don't know about David Peterson in that role. If I recall correctly, in 2015, I think we were leaning on John Neese as a left-handed reliever after being a starter his whole career. Worked out okay. It wasn't his fault we didn't win the World Series. So there's lots of parts here. The good news is that these are the margins that we're talking about. Why I don't feel terrible about McNeito or McCann, whatever you want to call the budding platoon behind the plate, is we upgraded the DH. Why does that matter to me in terms of the catcher? Because I think you can live with one position that is about defense if you have a good enough team. A la Rafael Santana batting, I believe, 218 in 1986. Nobody cared because Rafael Santana was a good defensive shortstop. That's what you needed. You had plenty of hitting. Jerry Grody, circa 1969, was not Johnny Bench at the plate. Behind the plate, just as good, if not better. They love throwing to Neito. They love throwing to McCann, the they in this case being the pitchers. So when you had two black holes in the lineup, the catching position and the DH, which was really tough because the whole idea of the DH is the H, the hitting. And when it was J.D. Davis and Dom Smith, and as much as we came to adore both of them, circa 2019, the Cookie Club, the whole bit, neither one was hitting remotely consistently. They were more inconsistent than Joely Rodriguez, let's put it that way. And now we are in a new phase with one guy, Daniel Vogelbach, who we've seen a good bit of, and we're pretty impressed, I think, with what he can do with a bat and what he can do with the strike zone, and Darren Ruff, who we haven't seen at all as a Met, but we've seen the track record, and he seems to be in a better place right now than J.D. Davis was. So if we're getting real production at the designated hitter role, then the rest of the lineup is better, and we have one spot that's kind of a problem. I don't think Neito's the disaster you paint him to be, because he does come up with a hit now and then. He's a very good bunter. The question is, do you really want him bunting down three runs? I wasn't crazy about that either, but we'll leave that be. And as far as getting all-star catchers from Chicago, we got one in James McCann, remember? He was an all-star catcher in Chicago for the White Sox. Listen, it hasn't really been a offensive fireworks coming out of his bat, but I can trust those guys. The bottom line, did I say bottom line again? My God, welcome to Cliche Stadium, ladies and gentlemen. The bottom line is this is a very good team as is, tweaked a little bit since the trade deadline, and this is the team we got. So we can pick apart Billy Epler's statements and take issue with what he didn't do, and that's fine. That's part of being a fan. But this is what we got. So I'm not going to bang my head against the wall or any other part of my anatomy against any other part of any structure. I'm just going to go with it because we gotta. You know, this is our team. So we will have a pretty, well, we'll have a great idea by early October, but we'll have a little better idea once we play the Braves, five games in the upcoming weekend. And we play the Phillies a couple of series. I think we play the Braves again in Atlanta. So we'll know that if they, who made bolder moves perhaps from further back, are going to reap those rewards. And, oh, my God, why didn't we do anything? All we were being was 66-38. Well, again, I think I'm showing I have a little confidence in the team that we've got. And there's nothing I can do about it because that they don't let me make trades on behalf of the organization.
I suspect that the organization was somewhat hesitant to trade big prospects because of last year's trade when they sent Pete Crow Armstrong to the Cubs for Javi Baez, Trevor Williams, and Javi Baez's middle finger. That trade should not have precluded a trade this year. A hindsight opinion of that deal should not have colored this year. But I agree with you in the sense the Mets are in first. A good team has gotten better. And I'm trying to focus on that.
Yeah, and you have spots in the field where you have short-term solutions. McCann was always a short-term solution. And Escobar is a short-term solution at third base. And now a platoon third baseman. I didn't really want to trade our big catching prospect. I certainly didn't want to trade our big third base prospect. I think there has to be some give and take between that whole prospects and parades quotient that people talk about. You've heard the saying, prospects are cool, parades are cooler. There's no guaranteeing anything, either for the future or the very near future. So I'm going to have my faith in what Billy Epler tried to do. Again, if you're shadowed by last year's deal that only marginally worked out, I'm not even saying it worked out net, because Pete Crow Armstrong was a good prospect then, a good prospect now. Javi Baez obviously left without bringing the Mets to any glory. And Trevor Williams has been a nice piece, by the way, and he's come in quite handy. So you can't let that guide you forever. I don't know that it did, but it also doesn't mean that, like, let's shoot it at the wall and see what happens one more time. Let's roll the dice at the wall, I think is what I'm trying to say. Again, they did what they did. They didn't do what they didn't do. Let's roll.
Well, one of the reasons the Mets are rolling is because of Starling Marte. And recently, Greg, you made a great comparison between Starling Marte and one of our favorite Mets. It was such a good comparison that it made me see red in a good way.
Did you see red or did you see orange? Yeah, I don't know why, but intermittently throughout this year, and I like the fact that it keeps kind of coming back to me. So I look at Starling Marte in 2022, playing right field, doing all the things he does, and it brings me back to Rusty Staub in 1972. Not the Rusty Staub of the 1980s, who was a wonderful folk hero, but more of a Daniel Vogelbach type by then. Great pinch hitter and a great clubhouse presence and all of that. And, of course, we adore that Rusty Staub. But the Rusty Staub who came over in 1972 was a player who you felt could do it all. Again, he was never fast. He ran the bases well. He was a smart outfielder. He was hitting like crazy. And just the spark plug, not a spark plug in the Jose Reyes top of the order sense, but the guy who made over the lineup. And 1972 is famous in the circles of people who know these things as a year that the Mets got off to one of the best starts they ever had. For years, it was the best start they ever had until 86. And Rossi Staub was at the heart of that. Well, why do we never talk about that championship that the 1972 Mets won? Because Rossi Staub's hand was broken by a pitch from George Stone that June, and he tried to play through it, and he wasn't able to, and eventually he had to go on what was then called the disabled list, and the year fell apart for other reasons, a lot of injuries. But I still have that image of Rossi Staub as the difference maker, guy who knew what he was doing, the professional, the guy you knew was good. And mind you, I was 9 years old at the time, but what else did I have to concentrate on? You knew he was good. You knew he'd been an all-star in Montreal. But oh my God, now he's a Met. What a difference he's making. And that's what it's been like watching Starling Marte, who, again, I knew he was good. I'd seen him play for Pittsburgh, saw him play for the Marlins, was very happy when we got him. I may not have appreciated just how important he would be to this team. Again, runs faster, certainly, than Rossi Staub when his legs aren't bothering him. Fortunately, he hasn't had one of those injuries that has knocked him for a loop. A couple of times he's had to miss a few days here and there, but he's always come back. He's hit for power. He has played a really good right field, a position not only that Rossi Staub played, but a position he hadn't played before, because Brandon Nimmo set up his flag in center field and said, I'm the center fielder, and the Mets went along with it. Marte just shrugged and said, I'll play wherever you want me to play. Once in a while, makes a bad throw, makes up for it the next day with a great throw. It's been mostly heads up. Just a real professional, and if not like a megastar, not a Juan Soto exactly, that next level, and meshes well with what this team has become. So, yeah, now and then I look at Starling Marte and I see a shock of red hair. This is as strange as that sounds. No, they don't look alike and they don't run alike, but they produce alike. And if you look at the numbers from when before Rossi Staub got injured in 72, you look at the numbers that you're seeing out of Starling Marte all year long, they're comparable. And I think the impact is comparable. And fortunately, he's out there every day. So, yeah, LeGrand Starling, welcome to New York, pal. I will visit your restaurant as soon as you want to open one.
I wonder if Starling Marte knows who Rossi Staub was. Hopefully he does. I think he'd appreciate what you said.
Well, I'd like to believe that Starling and Eduardo and Mark and all the new Mets this year, they all took a stroll over to the Mets Hall of Fame. They took a look at the plaques and said, oh, I want to get to know my Mets history. And they know those things. So it's been a busy week in Mets land. And we've seen guys come and go. We've seen the likes of ex-Mets like Brandon Drury on the move. We talked about him in the utility specials that we did. We've seen our old friend Thor, Noah Syndergaard, get back dragged into the National League East. That'll be interesting. We've seen Jerry Familia sent packing by Philadelphia. And you've seen the New York Mets up close in your neck of the woods 3 days in a row. You have been dabbing your forehead and just trying to dry out, because I know it's hot as hell in Washington, D.C. this time of year. What was life like at Nationals Park as the Mets were going 2-1 down there this week?
Well, if we had this discussion last night, my mood would have not been as good as it is now. I did go to all three games, which is the first time I've ever gone to an entire series. I went Monday, sat all the way in the left field corner, and the Mets had Max Scherzer on the mound, and Scherzer pitched well, not at the top of his game. But what was interesting was, from my perspective, was that as soon as the Nationals got close and made it a one-run game, he seemed to get better. And I thought he'd be out after five. I thought he'd be out after six. He stayed in the game for seven. He looked great, and he seemed to get better as the game went on. Another observation about Scherzer: for years, I've been watching Mets walk from the bullpen to the third base dugout. Mets pitchers always walk in with their catcher and with the bullpen coach, always, until Monday. Scherzer walks alone. I went on Tuesday night. It was electric. There were so many Met fans there. I even heard two of them say the same comment. It sounds like Shea. It's been 14 years. No one says it sounds like Citi Field. It sounds like Shea. There was a guy in front of me, an older gentleman, wearing a Cleon Jones 21 jersey. Yes. And I complimented him on it. And he looked at me and said, when I was in Little League, Cleon Jones and Bud Harrelson gave my team our championship trophy. So that was wonderful. And the game started, and a standing ovation for everything DeGrom did, walking out to the bullpen, walking back from the bullpen, accompanied by Nito and Hefner, walking onto the mound, striking the guys out, and then it got quiet. I think everybody was tired after the first inning, and the Mets' bats looked tired, and it was a sad game as the back end of our bullpen gave up home runs to minor leaguers. I also went today. It was hot. It was humid. But I was gifted club seats. I was behind home. And I'm sure everybody in our listening audience saw me from the third row behind home because I was there. At one point, I went to the restroom. And when I came back, Greg said he knew I went to the bathroom because he saw me sit down during the inning. In the ninth inning, I was on my feet for a while, and Michael Givens wasn't great. And the inning went on and made me and my friend Kirby think of the Kurt Suzuki game. Apparently, Gary Cohn thought of it too. But it was a wonderful experience being up close and seeing the Mets that close, especially Daniel Vogelbach, who's a big human being, but he had a big grand slam today. And it was a wonderful experience. So 2 out of 3, beating the Nationals, not optimal. 3 out of 3 would have been better. But anytime they beat the Nationals is wonderful.
We know that beating the Nationals is always wonderful. Coming home is even better. Winning 2 out of 3. Hey, you know what that reminds me of? That's a .667 winning percentage. Do you know what team finished the year with a .667 winning percentage? That's right, the 1986 New York Mets. Can I just throw a statistic at you before we wind down? The 1986 Mets, 2 mileposts in their season have stayed with me forever. They got off to a 20-4 start after 24 games, and they were 44-16 after 60 games. And no Mets team has come close to either of those marks. But I just got to throw this at you. From game 25 to game 104 that year, which is roughly half a season, 80 games, the 1986 Mets went 50-30, including the 2-1 in Washington, which you found a passing grade. The 2022 Mets over that exact same span, game 25 to game 104, 50-30. The 2022 Mets, when you allow for the amazing start of the 1986 Mets, have been every bit as good as that 1986 team, which didn't do a whole lot at the trade deadline that year, which had just moved to July. In fact, the only pickup they made before the season was over was a guy named Lee Mazzilli, who was released by the Pirates and they let George Foster go. I just wanted to point that out, not so much for the numbers, but just to clarify that the plane this team is playing on is historic. And I know that we get caught up in why didn't they get a left-handed relief pitcher or why didn't they take 3 of 3 from every minor league type opponent that's out there. They're doing what they need to do, and we want them to do what they need to do against the Braves. And finally, I just want to reiterate something that you said. Jacob DeGrom is back, and you got to see him in person. I got to see him on TV. God, wasn't that great? I mean, I think you're right that it probably took the air out of the tires, so to speak, all the excitement. I know I felt it. And then it was sort of a downer to have to play the rest of the game. But my God, Jacob DeGrom is back. The Mets are in first place. What the hell? Bring on Atlanta. Bring on Philadelphia. Bring on Noah Syndergaard, whatever uniform he's wearing. 2022 Mets. I'm having a really good time. Glad this is the team that we get to talk about the year we decide to do this.
and five games with Atlanta, how do you think Citi Field's going to be?
I think Citi Field will be partly anxious and partly full of bloodlust. And I hope that contributes to more wins than losses in those five games. And then we can do the part where we say, oh, but will they let down against the Reds? Because that was supposed to be the problem after sweeping two from the almighty Yankees. Oh, but they're going to let down against the Marlins, who they swept, by the way. One game at a time, wherever it is. But I'm glad you had a good time. I'm glad you had access to the facilities and that I could see you doing whatever you do on television. That was a lot of fun.
I don't think this team is capable of a letdown. They had Miami and Washington on the schedule before Atlanta, and they won 5 out of 6. I think Buck keeps them on the straight and narrow.
These are professionals, just to reiterate the phrase I used before. You know what's different about this team, I think, from last year, aside from obvious personnel changes and better pitching and those sorts of things? They're having fun. They're having a good time. Lots of bonhomie. But they are more serious about what they're doing. You know what I don't see this year? I don't see the home run horse in the dugout. And I don't see Donnie Stevenson. And I'm not hearing about rats and raccoons. And it was fun when they were winning, and it was grating when they were losing. And I suppose if they were losing, we'd say, why don't they show more emotion? They show plenty of emotion. They seem to understand that they have a mission. And I don't know if that's Buck. I don't know if that's Scherzer. I don't know if it's just the synergy in the clubhouse, the alchemy, whatever you would want to call it. But it's a real delight for fans like us who've been watching this team a long time. Again, not just for a lead in the National League East, but just for the way they conduct themselves. It feels like a good group. And, you know, we've now lived with them for 2/3 of a season. So, no, I don't go into situations expecting letdowns. And I find myself sort of insulted on their behalf when I hear writers and other media members asking Buck after games, well, were you worried about a letdown? Were you worried about the worst possible thing that could have happened because they're the Mets? And he just doesn't have any of it. And I don't think that that's what these players are, whether it's the players who've come from elsewhere or the players who have survived the last couple of strange years and are now maturing. And again, you know what? We will write the characteristics we wish to write when it suits our narrative purposes, I suppose. But I really feel that way. This is a professional team. And look, if they somehow don't win enough games, whether in the regular season or in the postseason, well, we maybe will look back on it and say, well, we should have seen that coming or whatever. But it's not our job to see it coming. It's our job to get excited. And I'm excited about this team every day and every night in a way I haven't been in a long time. And they give us reason to.
Well, the bottom line is that this is an excellent team, and I can't wait for these five games.
Same here.
And that'll do it for this episode of National League Town. We'll be back next week to start our series, Getting You Ready for Old Timers Day. We want to thank you for listening. And if you like what you're hearing, make sure to rate our show on Apple and Spotify. And Greg, if they rate us, how should they rate us?
5 stars, 6 stars, however many stars you can spare. We thank you for your support.
Until then, I'm Jeff Heisen.
I'm Greg Prince.
And as always, let's go Mets. Copyright 2022, music provided by the Royal Arctic Institute. Check them out on Spotify.